We welcome you to our monthly pastor's chat. We've got a good one this time, and you're going to be so glad that you're a part of it. I'm Steve Brown, the old white guy, and I'm sitting here with pastors, Zach Van Dyke, who woke up one morning and found himself the pastor of a mega church and didn't know what in the world he was going to do.
Nope.
And then my pastor, Kevin Labby, is here, and Kevin very soon is going to have a mega church, yeah. And you won't know what to do with it either. Our guests are Neil Salzman and Jeremiah Simmons. Neil and Jeremiah, among other things, sat in my classes at Reformed Theological Seminary. At the end of this chat, I'll let you know whether I take credit for it or not. Neil is the executive director and founder of the REST Initiative. Jeremiah is a behavioral health coach with the organization. They've been practicing together for a number of years, dealing with all sorts of problems. So if you have a meltdown, you need some help and some guys that are quite confident, they're your answer. You ought to write this down, therestinitiative.org. That's therestinitiative.org. Both Neil and Jeremiah are licensed mental health counselors and graduates of Reformed Theological Seminary. Okay, first, let's find out what this thing is about. I saw the REST Initiative and thought maybe it was a sleeping clinic. But that's not what it is. So first, tell us a little bit about the REST Initiative.
Thank you for having us. It's great to be here.
Thanks.
Good to have you.
But the REST Initiative started probably 3 years ago as an attempt to offer rest to pastors and missionaries and those working in environments that are where there's heavy stress, lots of burnout, lots of fatigue, to offer rest proactively, to think ahead of the game and not just be reactive. So it's a support network.
By the way, over 23 years ago, my life came apart. I had a meltdown emotionally. I'd like to say it was compassion fatigue, but it was probably sin. But at any rate, I had a real, nobody knew it. I kept a good up front, and that's what most missionaries and pastors do. They keep a good up front. But my world came to an end. I ended up resigning the next day after spending most of the night sobbing and didn't know why. I didn't tell anybody till much later, but I spent a year trying to get what you guys give. And I wish I had known you then. I think it would make a difference. So I just want you to know I've been there and I've done that. And so when I talk about it, I'm aware existentially of what being very religious and very professional, being all of those things and yet having your world come to an end. This started mostly with missionaries. I thought everything was fine on the mission field.
Yeah. Yeah, it would be great if that was the case, but our hope is we can make it better. But your story is one that inspired us, not yours particularly, but that story is one that we've heard often in our offices over and over again. And that's essentially where the REST Initiative was kind of birthed, hearing those kind of stories from pastors and clergy. And I'm not one that's tied to statistics, but as you said, you left ministry. 45% of folks in ministry end up leaving their ministries at some point in time because of burnout and compassion fatigue. Oh, and it's stories that we, you know, being folks in Orlando, we've heard a lot, even in some of our local churches, what that does to pastors. And it's a dual-edged sword, I think, for people in ministry because they get hit with burnout, overworked, too many hours, too many responsibilities. But then they also get compassion fatigue, which is the idea of hearing these hard stories and not having the space to process them emotionally. So it's a double-edged sword with pastors. It makes sense why the burnout and why so many pastors end up leaving their jobs.
If you're not a pastor, you're going 45%. Good Lord. But if you're a pastor, you're wondering why it isn't more.
Yeah,
there should be a lot more. I have a friend in Texas who said to me one time. He said, Steve, pray for me. I can't find the balance between caring too much and not giving a damn. That was a wise statement. I've thought about it ever since he said it, because every pastor knows that that's exactly where they are, trying to find some kind of balance. But anyway, talk to us about pastors and missionaries. Describe some of the problems you encounter, and then we'll all participate in the conversation.
Yeah. I mean, I can start off and just talk a little bit about burnout and just kind of tell you what that looks like. And burnout can happen in a lot of different jobs. I think it's an epidemic in ministry.
Yeah.
I would use that word. It's a strong word, but I think it fits from as much as we've heard it and we've seen it. And most pastors, you know, in quiet rooms with nobody listening will attest to.
Now, is that manifested in stuff like clinical depression, suicidal thoughts?
Absolutely.
Like, I got to do something else or I'm going to die?
Yeah, over time, the long-term effects of it can very much be depressive disorders, anxiety disorders, mood disorders, and that's where you see affairs happening, and even, unfortunately, suicide.
Oh, man. I've been in pulpits right after the pastor committed suicide. You talk about a mess.
Yeah.
That's a bad deal.
When I work with missionaries or those in ministry, there's a mentality that we have to have it together, that we have to have the answers, and I don't know if that's the celebrity pastor mentality in kind of our culture, or possibly the consumer mentality,
yeah,
where you have to produce a product,
yeah,
and so there's this pressure to perform really well. And I think
never
that
stops.
Where I find, and I see pastors in places like isolation, they disconnect and they isolate themselves. Even things like obesity or addictions. Jim Cofield mentioned to me, a professor at RTS, that it's the only profession. Clergy is the only profession where you train for 3 years and the average length of stay is 4.
Mm-hmm. Good.
And so you invest all of this time and energy and money. And you know, if we did that with our lawyers or our doctors, somebody would say, something's got to shift here.
Maybe not with lawyers, but
maybe
definitely
not. No, lawyers. But the amount of money that goes into that and time, and then after 4 years, average pastor's burned out or just had enough or is taking on too much. And that, not even to mention the family, how it affects their family and children.
Yeah. You know, I'm working on a new book on masks and hidden agendas, and I'm writing it for lay people, but it, in fact, is for pastors. And once you start one of these things, it's like a steamroller. You can't stop. So I've been doing a lot of thinking about the way we hide from each other and the hidden agendas that we have. And because I am who I am, when I think of that, I think of professional religionists.
Yeah.
We are so afraid. Jim Baird, one time, a friend of mine, said to his congregation when I was there, if you really knew me, you wouldn't want me to be your pastor. Mm-hmm. And then he smiled and he said, if I knew you, I wouldn't want you to be my congregation, which said a lot. But we're really afraid that if they really knew us, if we did what you suggested we ought to do, and that is to not be perfect, to quit performing, to say I'm as screwed up as you are, if we did that, we're afraid we're going to be fired and we're going to lose our job.
Yeah.
In fact, that's not true. And I've got two guys here that illustrate that point. I mean, they take off their underwear in the pulpit. And I'm speaking metaphorically,
oh, thank you.
But I can't tell you the number of times I've heard these two guys preach and thought, I don't believe I'd have said that. But they have, and you've discovered something, haven't you,
absolutely,
in doing that?
Absolutely.
They rise up and call you blessed, don't they?
A lot of times they do. That's exactly right, yeah. I think a lot of people are waiting to be given permission. Mm-hmm. To take off their mask, and when they see a leader doing that. But I just remember going through seminary and not feeling that. And, you know, with social media expanding, I found myself, when that was first coming online, Facebook, Twitter, and so on, I would go on Twitter and I would follow these guys, thinking that, oh, it'd be great to hear from, you know, Paul Tripp and Tullian and follow all these guys. And I found that it had this counterintuitive effect on me. Hmm. I didn't emerge from it, oftentimes pointed to the gospel as much as they were speaking about the gospel. I was, in my own sin, the problem wasn't them, was I was saying, well, why can't I be that prolific? Why can't I be that articulate? Why can't I be and the weight of that was really, for a time, very debilitating.
But you've given it up. You don't play that game.
Yeah, no, you're really right. Not. You really do realize that if I keep in that way, the end result is going to be a four-year ministry. Yeah. But if I believe the gospel and I have people around me who are encouraging me, and you had spoken to isolation, I think that is just dead on. If you're surrounding yourself with folks who are allowing you to speak into their life even as they speak into yours, you can feel unhinged from that. And the paradox is you become even more effective in reaching and truly ministering and seeing the gospel transform when you're that way than when you're trying to be a professional religionist and pretend.
Yeah,
I think for both of you, you need a mean streak. So, you know, most people rise up and call you blessed, and you got to be meaner than the ones who don't. So that's a part of it. But that's really where your power is, isn't it, Zach?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you went to a church that was in shambles. Mm-hmm. I mean, there had been a suicide before you got there of the pastor. And some other really.
No, actually, while I was, I mean, he
oh,
was.
You
already,
were the.
He,
that's
he
right.
had already and, left, oh, but God. But yeah, yeah. Wow.
And they worshipped at that guy's altar, and Zach got up. I mean, most people would sweep that under the rug and try to keep it as small as you could. Man, you brought it up and addressed it straight on, and said you didn't know what to do, And that, are you insinuating? I don't know if you said it that way, but that was your demeanor.
Mm-hmm.
And those people love you.
Mm-hmm.
Kevin, you've done the same thing. You told me off air that you guys are proactive. I mean, you don't, of course, a part of your practice is dealing with the, you know, the ones that have fallen off the cliff already, and you try to clean up the blood and patch up the wounds and all that stuff. But your real thrust is proactive. You want to fix it before it happens. What if a young guy comes to you and says, I'm a pastor, and I've looked at everybody who's fallen off that cliff, and I've seen the blood, and I don't want to go there. Can you help me? What would you say to somebody like that?
The metaphor that we use often is we're busy sending ambulances into the valley to clean up the mess. And a lot of counselors do that. A lot of presbyteries do that. What we're interested in is how do we develop a little fence on top of the cliff so people quit falling down there? We'll always need ambulances. We'll always need people to go in and for crisis and situations that we have no control over. But we're really concerned about the little fence on top of the cliff. And that's that proactive approach. And so I would say if someone comes to us, it's a process, a longer journey. It's let's start now getting to know each other, out of isolation, developing relationships like you'd mentioned. To make sure that certain things are in place, like relationships, finding a rhythm to that. Typically, you know, we'll meet with you every 3 weeks. We'll be in a relationship and we'll develop a relationship with you. And so when the crisis does hit, maybe it's a year, maybe it's 2 years down the road, intimacy is already developed. There's resources there where someone doesn't have to hide, and which causes more frantic behavior.
So you model that yourselves. By being that to some of the guys.
That's our attempt is, not only in our own lives.
What
but
are you doing, groups or individually or both or what?
It's both, yeah. I mean, I think the opportunity is there for both, and I think both is necessary because you need, I think a pastor needs to look across, as you all can do, and look at each other in our eyes and say, I've been there, I know what it's like even now. Yeah.
I'm so pro-counseling. I've known Neil for a long time and thankful for him. Try to go out to lunch with him so that he'll give me free counseling. And I'm sitting here and I'm thinking, of course, like we all should do this and this makes so much sense. But then I started thinking about just in my own last 2 weeks, 2 weeks ago, I had just a horrible week. The sermon was killing me. It wasn't coming. I was mean to my family because I couldn't get the sermon right. And I wasn't good at work. Like it was just like everything was coming apart. And I got sick, like physically sick because of like the anxiety over not feeling like I had something that was of any worth to offer anyone. And God was faithful and Sunday happened and Sunday went fine. And I survived it. And then this week, the sermon just wrote itself, and it was so easy. And 2 weeks ago, Kelly kept saying to me, Zach, you've got to go talk to someone. Like, this is not healthy. But because I had a healthy week this week, the sermon came easy. I've been sweet to my family. I'm not going to do it. So you're right. I mean, this is a great idea, but I think convincing us and in our own hard-headedness and probably our own pride that we actually need to do it, unless you catch me on the week that the sermon's not coming, I'm going to think, you know what, I'm okay. You know, I don't want to spend the church's resource. I don't want to spend my own resources. Like, I'm good. And I know it's worth it, but...
How do you teach sick people they're sick?
Right.
Yeah, I think it takes a radical reorientation of what it means to be a good pastor. Mm. And I think it's you all here on the front line speaking to pastors, Kevin, as you even said before, saying, I'm giving that up. I'm no longer going to chase that false idol. Mm. And figuring out kind of the mysterious long process of what it actually means to be a good pastor, because it's not about sacrificing yourself, your well-being, your family at the altar of being a good quote-unquote pastor. Mm-hmm. I think it takes a reorientation to figure out what a soul care look like for me. And the hard part is, I think we find often as we've sat with pastors that have hit walls much harder than that one, or walls over and over again, banging their heads against it, the question I think everybody wants is, what are the processes that I need to take? And it's a much more mysterious answer than that, because it's a personalized answer. It's almost like asking, how do you like your coffee? Well, you know, I like it this and, you know, this much sugar. You know, it's a personal thing. So I think it takes, and this is the catch-22 for pastors, it takes time and energy and unhurried time to let yourself with God, with yourself, with friends that know you deeply, to really come into contact with that question, how do I love myself well? What does soul care look like for me? Mm-hmm. And that is profoundly hard, because the catch-22 that we get caught in as pastors is, I can't do that. That sermon's waiting for me to write.
Sunday's still coming.
Sunday is still coming, and I need to be a good pastor. Mm-hmm. So that's the catch-22.
You, Jeremiah, you bring up God and spirituality and stuff like that. Since you brought it up.
Since it's on the table now.
You know, actually, all of us have been to graduate school. All of us have gone through the rigor of studying systematics and apologetics and languages and all that stuff. But I think sometimes there's a disconnect from the reality of the doctrine to how it affects us as pastors and as individual Christians.
Yeah.
For instance, you know, if we start with a view of God who's a tyrant, who demands, who is holy and expects us to be holy, who has called us with the angels and the flaming coal that he puts on our lips, who laughed at Jeremiah when he wept. If we start at that point with a God like that, then we're going to end up not even lasting 4 years.
That's right.
We got to start theologically and biblically, and then as that works its way out in our lives spiritually. And that's really where you start in it.
Yeah. Yeah, well said. I always tell people it's fun. And almost paradoxical for us seminarians and MDiv grads to sit down and say, let's go back and really just look at the life of Jesus. Let's look at how he acted. And it's profound how he was not on the fast track to be, quote unquote, a good pastor. He was sleeping on the boat when everybody needed him. He goes away to the mountains to pray and leaves people constantly. He's letting people anoint him with expensive oils. In some sense, he is radically different than a lot of us would imagine he would be. And that doesn't mean that he's not sacrificial, but I think he does it from a place that you're kind of describing. He doesn't do it out of kind of coming out of underneath a tyrannical God. It's because he's the beloved. And I think profoundly that frees us. That's what frees us up, I think.
Credit first time.
I think that frees us actually to then approach the reorientation to soul care and thinking differently what it means to be a good pastor.
Let me make a statement and then let's talk about it a little bit. Without a theology of God's grace and mercy, there can be no boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
Without a gospel of grace and a God of grace, you find yourself living under obligation.
Yes.
Or heavy responsibility.
To him and to others.
That's right.
Yeah, to both. And that's exactly. And that obligation, that weight, as you described earlier, that weight, that to carry that weight is not human. It's not what we're meant to be, to carry that. And so without grace, you can't put the boundaries up. You can't say, no, you know what, I need time to take care of myself. Because you have an obligation. You take care of them. And I love what Chuck DeGroat says in his book, Loving Tough People. He says that when we end up doing is we end up offering people an illusion of what the gospel is. It's not the gospel. Yeah. It's an illusion of try harder, be better, do more work. With grace, knowing that I am the beloved, it gives me permission, as was said earlier, to put up boundaries, to say it's not my responsibility or you have a decision to make and I can take care of myself. Mm-hmm. I can figure out what soul care looks like for me. So I think without grace, you live under obligation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the boundaries have to do with God, too. Mm. I mean, if a God demands everything, and he does, he demands our deaths. But other than that, we believe God demands a lot of things. And we've been told by professors and preachers all our lives. And we read the biographies written by people who are twits because they never tell you the dark side.
Mm-hmm.
You never hear about Spurgeon's depression and suicidal thoughts. You never hear about Berkeley wanting to become a Buddhist. You never hear about those kinds of things. And so we've got a God who says, you think, I heard a preacher say in our chapel at seminary one time, you don't have enough money to fix your car? Who said that God owes you a car?
Wow.
Listen, you guys would know the name of the person who said it. And he went down a long list. And I was sitting on the first row, fairly visible because I taught there. But if it had been any other situation, I would have made an obscene gesture and walked out.
Yeah.
Because they lied about God, who doesn't have any boundaries. I loved what you said about Jesus.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I've never thought about it that way.
Yeah. It's something I think we read about. We know it kind of in our heads, but I don't think we know it in our hearts. We don't live it in that profound way. I often like to kind of challenge pastors with the question of, do you think Jesus loved himself? And I think they kind of struggle. I mean, and I struggle with it. It's the idea of like, ooh, did Jesus say no to care well for himself? Well, I mean, yeah, I think biblically we can say he did. But it's a hard thing to embrace because I think often we kind of take the idea of love our neighbors as we love ourselves. Well, I tell you what, most congregants wouldn't want us as pastors to love them as we love ourselves, because we don't love ourselves very well often.
Yeah. Well, you think that question, ask him if he ever lusted.
Yeah, that's another,
That's even worse, man. They go nuts over it. And yet, the reason for the incarnation, it is not unreasonable to think of God every time by looking at Jesus.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because that's what that was all for.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we don't. Mm-hmm. I mean, we dip into places we ought not go. Mm-hmm. That are not biblical, that don't exegete the text right. Man, hard stuff. Yeah. So are you going to get counseling?
I guess.
We're
going to
lunch.
I'm just going to start going to lunch with
you. Buy lunch. You can get it free.
Okay, all right. Good.
Yeah. But you know, and I'm not one. I'm with Zach. I really believe in counseling. I believe in the disciplines that you've learned. Yeah. I think what you do is so very important. But a lot of counseling, as Larry Crabb says, should kind of take place among the people of God.
Yes.
You know, Zach, if I can take the fact that you screwed up the sermon and that I don't think you've made a permanent job of it, and if you screwed it up every week from now on and walk with you, you know, you wouldn't have to pay me.
Hmm.
I mean, that's the counseling. And that's what we've got to teach the people of God on our behalf. Mm. You do that all the time.
Mm.
You'll say something that's really kind of hard, and then you'll back up and say, just want you to know I don't live this.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, people, you can see lights going on all over the place. And there is a sense in which both of you guys are creating what both of these guys charge to give you. You're creating a soft, loving, kind, relational place. It's your nest where you're going to have to live too.
That's really kind. I think one thing along that line that's been so nice over the arc of ministry is just seeing a transition from my early ministry where it was very performance-driven, appearance-driven by consequence, versus coming to a deeper, and I'm not there by any stretch of the imagination, but I really do think you could divide those years, seeing the type of church and disciples that were produced within each climate and culture. And I think you're right. When you are around a group, you know, you two, I can imagine many of the folks with whom you minister and to whom you minister go back to their organization or their team within the organization, and the culture there is transformed incrementally. But over time, there's momentum where they do become gradually more and more equipped to speak truth into one another's lives. We have an assistant pastor at our church, Kurt, who is every bit a counselor to me as much as, you know, a pastor of the congregation. He'll speak hard truth and expose idols through questions and other things. But it's not in a condemning or a debilitating way. It's really gotten to a point where the thing that maybe I feared most early in my ministry, which was to be found out, I now long to be found out. Where am I wrong here? What value do I have here that's, you know, making this toxic when it should be held? So I can imagine the radiating effects of your ministry probably going out far. Have you seen that?
The development of the REST Initiative is, and I've said this often, that 75-80% of the counseling that I do, I shouldn't have to do.
That's right.
It should be done in the church.
Wow.
That's right.
And if part of the desire is to equip pastors and to offer pastors what they can offer their congregants, it's not counseling. Mm-hmm. I hate that people have to come to my office and sit and make sure everything's confidential and be mm-hmm. careful who's going to walk in the door because they might know somebody.
Yeah.
To share their heart, to share what they might be struggling with. And so much of what I want to see, we want to see, is that the church could do that.
Yeah.
And I think that's under the idea of a pastor himself taking good care of himself, understanding practically what grace does in his life.
That would bring a revival.
It sure would.
What happened to the church, Zach? How do we get in this place? I mean, Jesus didn't do it to us. Is there just something about religion that makes you weird?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I got 7 Christian of the Year awards, and now I'm a pastor. So, I mean,
there's one here.
Yeah, right.
We keep one of them here just to remind us to be good.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I know, like, for me, the calling of doing this kind of work, the reason I try to be honest, the reason I try to stand up there in my underwear or whatever, is because I also know one of the parts of the job that I love is the affirmation, is the standing in front of people, is the performance part. I mean, like, they're what's tied into my calling also is a huge downfall for me. And so if I'm not honest from the pulpit,
even about that,
right, then if I'm not honest, then all of a sudden the part of me that feeds off of kind of the celebrity or the being the upfront guy grows and grows and grows. So it's, I mean, every time I step in the pulpit, I feel like this is awesome and it's also awful.
Yes.
I mean, because of my own, you know, that's a tension that I still don't know how to deal with. The desire to be liked and idolized in people's eyes, and the desire to actually really legitimately use my gifts to help people see Jesus and help them see the grace that God gives them. And so,
and proactive care to that is, I want to carry that with you.
Yeah.
I don't want you to carry that alone when you step into that pulpit. And that might not be counseling.
Right.
Probably say, again, maybe 80% of even proactive care isn't counseling. It's being present. It's being able to offer an honest relationship.
Just hearing Zach say that, Zach's church is huge.
Yeah.
You know, mine's not.
Which we should say, since I've been there, it has declined in membership. So it was huge under the last guy. But
as a point, I think I don't think a guy like Zach might know. He's a sharp guy. I don't want to imply that he wouldn't necessarily know. But, you know, I think a lot of pastors tearing those things out, showing them to other pastors, is so reassuring.
Yeah.
You know, I just hearing Zach even confess that, because the last thing I would want to say is, you know, divide my ministry into a before and after as though the after is complete deliverance from what was before. That's not the case. I still struggle with the same thing. When I preach a clunker, I want to make a beeline for my office, lock the door, and pretend that I had a meeting so I don't see anybody after to greet them. The sense of shame is overwhelming.
And so to hear that you're not alone in that, that other pastors feel the exact same way.
Yeah. And that's what this thing is about.
Yeah.
You know, any pastor who says he doesn't struggle with mixed motives is living in denial, mm-hmm. or he doesn't give a rip. Mm-hmm. It's just the nature of who we are is, and the ministry we have is such. Listen,
one of the things I'm going to mess it up though, so hopefully you'll say it, is you say something about like, in order to be able to stand up in the pulpit, you have to, there's something. What you don't,
is that the, they put you, they were using that at the seminary. They put you 6 feet above everybody else, and shine a spotlight on you and give you a microphone and tell you to be humble.
Right. You can't do it. I don't think you're right. I don't think you can confess and repent.
If you think you can. Or you live in guilt because you haven't, mm-hmm. it'll kill you.
Yes. Yeah.
Let me radically change the direction we're going in. Most studies, and I participated in one at Boston University before any of you were born, the study was built around the question, why do people like us do what we do? And so this guy who was doing a Harvard PhD included rabbis and priests and pastors and clergy. And a part of my participating was that he agreed first to pay me. And in those days, you remember seminary days,
yeah,
man.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
ramen noodles.
You'd
ramen
sell noodles. Your soul for a dollar. Yeah. But the second thing that was a payback was that once he had finished the study, he would give us the results of that particular study. Now, this has been a lot of years ago. But it was sobering that how often we're driven by guilt, how often they're family issues, how often we're trying to please a father we could never please when we were growing up, how often abuse was a part of our background. I suspect that most of us do this religious thing. And God can do whatever he wants to do. I mean, if he wants to use all that stuff and make us do what no sane person would do, that's his business. We don't get a vote. But I do think that we have issues. Almost all of us who are religious professionals have issues that affect us emotionally. You think that's true, or am I just dreaming that up?
It's a good question. I don't know anything definitively numbers-wise that would back it up. But you got to kind of see there is a certain type that is drawn to the pulpit. Typically, they are more driven and by nature, enjoy a little bit of the limelight, so to speak, or catching some of Christ's reflected glory from the pulpit. And I think some of that, I think it's not okay, but it's also very normal. So yeah. I think to the degree, what we spoke about earlier of saying, can we wear that and can we confess that and even call out the ironic nature of standing in the 6-foot pulpit with lights shined on us. I think if we can wear that well, that's what keeps it from eating us alive and killing us.
Yes,
when we start to believe
that.
The own falsehood of ourselves and how we're the ones leading the church, I think that's when it starts to rot us from within.
Mm-hmm.
I do kind of feel that I, for instance, and I find a high degree of people that are in ministry, I'm the adult child of an alcoholic, with all that implies. Their dysfunctions is a part of that. Their control issues is a part of that. There is the need to be liked and the proclivity to lie that I've come to see as a part of who I was. And I don't think that I'm alone. I see that a lot. I hear it. And the trick is not to deny it. The trick is to embrace it.
You're right. I could not agree with you more. I think as I've looked at my own life, I was bullied as a young kid.
Yeah.
And my parents were divorced. For a time, I was estranged from my father, who he and I love one another. We have a great relationship now. But for a time, we were. And the predominant narrative in my life in those years was inadequacy.
Yeah.
And so not liked, inadequate. How am I going to meet that? And if I'm not guided by Christ and the gospel, it's up to me. It's performance. You know. And so I had to adapt. And so I love people. I love talking to people. I love relational stuff. But I've really had to test that. That can be a strength in the ministry
or it can really be something born of that idolatry, that self-compensating, that, you know, I'm going to be my own Messiah. Have I honed those gifts one way? And the fact of the matter is, I honed those gifts out of sin, self-reliance, but God in his grace can take those things and flip them and use those things for his glory. And I think that's a beautiful thing that you've just shared, because I think if we do a lot of self-examination, we're going to realize that some of the best things that have equipped us best for ministry are some of the worst things we've experienced in our lives.
Well, and I think a statistic that's, to your point, the only statistic that I'm pretty definite on is that 100% of pastors are broken.
Yeah.
What was the percentage you said that left after 45%?
End up leaving.
There's something wrong.
Yeah. Knowing our own brokenness is, you know, part of our proactive approach that we're even moving forward with is helping pastors know their own story. Yeah. If 100% of pastors,
what does that mean?
That means where did I come from? Yeah. What were the major fence posts in my life that changed the trajectory of my life?
Yeah.
The lies that I believed about myself, the moments I would say was survival. I learned certain things in my life to survive because my story was rough. My parents were divorced. I was bullied, and I learned techniques to save my life. And as the more I know my story, because I'm broken, the more I'll be more aware of what I say in the pulpit. And I think the more I'll be able to embrace the truth of grace, of the gospel.
Yeah.
So good.
That I am the beloved, not because I perform well or because I have a spotlight on me, but knowing my story well and having someone to carry the weight with you is what keeps us from having to do it alone and being the one that has to continue to survive.
That's so refreshing. It absolutely blows me away. Zach, you look like you were trying to say something. You got, or you were thinking about
nope,
dinner.
I feel like I've confessed enough.
I ain't going any further.
Yeah. I'm going to go out to lunch with Neil. That's what I came up with.
I'll tell you what, I'm going to land this plane, okay?
Real quick, here's what I like to give folks before they leave the office. I like to give them, basically I call it field work. It's homework. I just don't use the word homework, probably because you gave us too much in seminary, and I don't like the homework. But if your pastors are out there listening, a couple things just to maybe try to notice in your own lives and implement that could be life-changing, the domino effects in your ministries, in your families, in your lives. I think one is the idea of owning the brokenness that we all feel, so to speak, in ministry. And I think Kevin and Zach put good words to that overtly. What does it look like to be able to say, yes, I am there, and yes, I want to perform, and it's killing me? I think that takes the air out of it profoundly. I think two would be stop doing it alone. And you know, find some friends, find some kindred spirits, some good men in your life that you can let into those dark and hard places. Isolation kills us. Mm-hmm. And that does not mean that does not mean doing it at the elders' meeting. It means carving out specific time to be honest and let people in. So I think that is profound. And I think the third would simply be honest with your family and let them know that this is what it means to be a pastor. It's not pretty. It's ugly sometimes. It's hard. Some weeks the sermons come out like they're written by God himself. Other weeks we got to grunt them out like we're fighting something hard on the toilet. Either way, I think that...
I don't believe I'd have said that.
That's exactly.
We can edit that.
I'm using that. Make it into my next sermon.
But that is beautiful. That is owning, I think, the brokenness that we all feel.
So good. We can't end this like this. I'd like for you guys to come in again and let's do this again. I'd like
great.
That.
Great.
And listen, we're so glad that you joined us for this. Let me tell you who's going to be here next month. Rod Rosenblatt will join us for the next Pastor's Chat. He's a professor of theology and co-host of the nationally syndicated radio program Built on Grace called The White Horse Inn. You don't want to miss that. That's going to be fun. And again, thanks so much for joining us for this time.